This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent and diverse campus community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Israel has transgressed Article 2 of the Convention by committing actions that fall within the definition of genocide. The actions show a systematic pattern of conduct from which genocide can be inferred. The first genocidal act committed by Israel is the mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza.
That's Adila Hassam, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Adila Hassam, Richard Falk, and Irene Genzier on Gaza, a case of genocide. In the wake of the Holocaust in the 1940s, and earlier in the century, the genocidal attack against Armenians, the Polish jurist Raphael Lemkin coined the term genocide. In 1948, the UN adopted the Genocide Convention. On December 29, 2023, South Africa filed a case with the UN's International Court of Justice in The Hague, accusing Israel of the crime of genocide in its ongoing assault on Gaza. The convention defines genocide as, quote, the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Israel has dismissed the charge, calling it meritless. In the first part of this program, Joseph Gerson, president of the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, will be our moderator.
As we were shocked by and condemned the abominations of the brutal massacres of nearly 1,200 Israelis on October 7th, we and most of the world's nations stand horrified by what is widely understood as the IDF's genocidal assault against civilians in Gaza and by the escalating settler violence and land seizures in the West Bank. An estimated 23,000 Gazans, the vast majority of them children and women, have been killed in Gaza. That's roughly 20 times the number of Israelis killed in October. If we translate that proportionately into U.S. numbers, it's the equivalent of more than 3 million U.S. people. The U.N. humanitarian chief describes Gaza as uninhabitable. Yet the war goes on. Prime Minister Netanyahu pledges that the war will continue for 9 months to a year. And powerful currents in his government, the Netanyahu government, are pressing to thin, to ethnically cleanse Gaza's 2 million people. Another Nakba. And as we see from the Hezbollah-Israeli exchanges along the border with Lebanon, bombings in Syria and Lebanon, targeted assassinations in Lebanon and Iraq, and the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea, the danger remains that the war could explode into a regional cataclysm. President Biden's embrace of Prime Minister Netanyahu and massive U.S. weapons transfers to Israel have made what appears to be a genocide possible. It is also having broader and longer-term international ramifications. The U.S., as we see in U.N. votes, is increasingly isolated. These are very hard times. The need for a ceasefire and a credible process toward a just Israeli-Palestinian and Middle East peace are urgent necessities. My hope is that this evening's webinar will provide the historical background and current analyses that will add to pressure to end the killing and the apartheid, and toward a peace that respects the dignity and rights of both Palestinians and Israelis. Okay, then I could spend the next hour introducing our evening speakers, but I'll briefly introduce them in the order that they'll be speaking. Irene Genzier is Professor Emerita at Boston University. She is currently an affiliate in research at the Harvard Center for Middle East Studies. Richard Falk is the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University, and he served as the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine. We will start with Irene. A lot of people have not been following developments in the Middle East and are coming new to the crisis. So if you could kind of lay out, I hate to say it quickly, kind of a quick review of history, beginning with the origins of the conflict.
Let me tell you that one of the astonishing, perhaps, and depressing aspects of reviewing this material, which, by the way, is accessible to anybody who has a computer at hand. Just for start, you might go to something called FRUS, Foreign Relations of the U.S., 1948, look up Israel, Palestine, and that will take you on a long, long journey. That's one of the many sources that I've used. What is striking to me in reviewing this material is if you go back to the period prior to the establishment of Israel, that is the mandate period of the post-World War I, that included Britain's power as a mandatory authority in Palestine, the problems that we have today existed at that time. In other words, there was utter clarity about the fact that the Palestine mandate was riven, divided by forces, Jewish forces on the one hand, Zionist forces seeking the establishment of a state, Palestinian forces resisting such an outcome. There were a series of reports that were issued by U.S. sources, including the CIA, in 47 and 48, throughout those years, on the situation in Palestine. They are extremely revealing. This material is available online. They are revealing in a sense that they indicate the clarity with which the U.S. understood the conflict, understood the differences, was very cautious and calculating in its decision to back Israeli forces after May 48. The calculation was based on an assessment of U.S. regional interests with the belief that Israel's superior military forces would probably have a long-term impact in the region, and it was useful for the U.S. not to confront in a negative sense these forces, but rather to cooperate with them in supporting its own interests, meaning Arab oil. It looks from afar as a very odd combination, but in practice it wasn't. Insofar as Palestine was concerned, the sad truth is that U.S. officials, CIA, White House, they understood the conflict and at the same time decided that it was, if you want, a secondary matter that had the potential to disrupt broader U.S. interests. So if you look at U.S. reports in the fall of 1947, October, November through February 48, March 48, the Declaration of Israel's Independence, and July, the summer of 48, what I found of interest, and as I say, disturbing, was the U.S. position, which was first to calculate what impact this might have on U.S.-Soviet rivalry in the region. Once that became clear, then a more narrow focus on the situation within Palestine. And a very a clear assessment that Palestinian forces or those Arab forces supporting Palestinian forces were militarily inferior to what became Israel after May 48, and therefore were not worthy of U.S. support. There were differences U.S. government, that is to say, if you look at Department of State, CIA, Department of Defense, there was by no means total unanimity, but there was total clarity about what was going on, about the forces involved, and about the possible consequences. Ultimately, the decision of what to be done was based on the impact that Palestine would have on U.S. regional interests, meaning U.S. support for the oil-producing states. That perhaps is the general conclusion that this material leads to. Now, there was a very clear view also that moves to partition Palestine were vehemently opposed in the Arab world, supported within Jewish circles in Palestine, but with some questions. And that partition was nonetheless the probable and the most favorable outcome that the U.S. could expect from the situation in Palestine. So the CIA reports on the consequences of Palestine for November 47, February 48, yield a view of the Palestine problem not different from what we are looking at today.
Irene, thank you so much. Richard, to ask you about regional and international implications of the war. What are we seeing in terms of this reverberations? What does it mean in terms of where we're all headed in the coming years?
Well, one interesting way of responding would be to recall Samuel Huntington's 1993 article, The Clash of Civilizations, which ends with the provocative phrase, the West against the rest. And one of the striking features of the way in which the external alignments have developed is you find that the pro-Palestinian active forces are all on the Islamic side of the civilizational border or fault line, whereas those that support Israel in an active way are in the European colonial states and the white settler colonial states, of which the United States is the leading one. And the originality of this situation is quite extraordinary, because it is the states supporting Israel that have tried to occupy the high moral and legal ground in international political life and have chastised and criticized others for failing to be sensitive to the obligations of international law, of UN Charter, and so on. So you have this situation that has never existed before in relation to what increasingly seems a transparent example of severe genocide. You have the countries that supposedly were championing a world of democratic respect for human rights and law on the side of the genocidal actor, not only withdrawing from any active effort to prevent genocide, which is a central obligation of the Genocide Convention, but actually being complicit in providing material intelligence and diplomatic support throughout this crisis period. And in other words, to me, the actuality of genocide is complemented by these complicity crimes. And they're not included in this very timely South African initiative before the International Court of Justice that is seeking provisional measures to stop the genocide on the basis of evidence that's overwhelmingly documented in an 84-page, very well-crafted application for this sort of relief. So it's a very malevolently unusual situation in international life, where you have international law demeaned by those states that have historically championed its relevance and now oppose what seems like a strikingly reasonable appeal to the International Court of Justice by saying that that initiative is legally baseless and Israel has said it's a blood libel against the Jewish people. So we have a situation growing out of the carnage in Gaza and the spillover in the West Bank, which is really engulfing the entire world in one sense in a new kind of normative tension. The other thing I would like to say in response to your question is that Israel seems caught now between not being able to win nor being able to afford politically to lose. And their only option in that kind of situation, if I'm correct in assessing it in this way, is to expand the war and draw Iran into an active conflictual relationship that would in turn draw at least the U.S. into the conflict, and maybe using the pretext that Iran is close to acquiring nuclear weapons as the basis for launching an attack. It's a very precarious situation, which has no logical, plausible way of ending at this point, and has been horrifying up to this stage. And so it's hard to know what to do, even if the International Court of Justice does impose these provisional measures and order Israel to desist from further violence until the substantive decision is reached. It's unlikely that Israel will obey. Israel has consistently defied international law, and therefore there's a crisis of implementation. The law is there, but the political will to enforce it isn't present.
Let me then ask quickly, it's one thing to understand the world, the other thing, of course, is to change it. What would each of you advocate as or suggest to stop the killing and to prevent a wider war?
Well, I think the first thing I would ask is for the U.S. To make totally public the amount of economic and military aid it provides Israel, and to consider halting military aid to Israel at the present time.
Richard, what do you say?
As far as specific measures are concerned, I think in addition to making more transparent the degree to which the U.S. has supplied weaponry from U.S. taxpayer money would be an important supplement to the kind of rethinking of the relationship to Israel that is so important to take place. I would think that also proposing an arms embargo in the General Assembly and perhaps in the Security Council would have considerable symbolic and possibly substantive value. And the third specific thing I think would be timely would be a People's Tribunal of Persons of Conscience dedicated to clarifying and documenting what has happened since October 7th, and providing an opportunity for the peoples of the world to speak, including pointing to the failures of the intergovernmental system to take any kind of effective protective action. The best hope of the Palestinians is the mobilization of civil society at this stage. And the South African initiative is important because if this court gives a positive result to South Africa, it will escalate the popular participation through global solidarity, activism and pressure for boycotts in sports, culture, and other domains. That proved very successful in the struggle against South African apartheid. And Israel is becoming a pariah state that has made itself, through its behavior, through the outrageously open acknowledgement of genocidal intent, a pariah country or a rogue state. And this is a moment where civil society can produce a new balance of forces in the world. And if one looks at all the colonial wars, they were won by the weaker side militarily. And that's an important lesson for the 21st century, that it isn't weapons that control political outcomes. The U.S. should have learned that in Vietnam, where it won every battle, had total superiority in land, air, and sea, and yet lost the war. Part of the problem is it's unable to learn those kinds of lessons because of the strength of the military-industrial complex, the arms industry, the global geopolitical role being played by the U.S., all the military bases. So one's in a kind of dilemma where we know what we should be doing, but there's no way to get it done.
So a question from George Smith. If, inshallah, the U.S. decided to use the full power of its leverage to bring about an immediate, unconditional ceasefire in Gaza, could it succeed?
The answer is that the Israelis have not wanted a ceasefire, since the absence of such gives them an advantage that they can continue as they have been doing. Will the U.S. then break its intimate accord with Israel, informal with Israel, and say, no, we demand a ceasefire at the present time? I don't know. Maybe the answer in part has to do with the kind of external pressure that the U.S. is facing in the current situation. Maybe they will take that step. If they do, I think that it will be a significant break or significant shift or significant reassessment in U.S.-Israeli relations, which would be to the good. And I strongly hope for that. I think that insisting on holding back on a ceasefire is shameful from a humanitarian point of view and really exposes the kinds of interests that move U.S. policy.
Question here is concerned about the constant reference to Iran as supporting terrorism throughout the region. Richard, could you shed some light on the degree to which Iran is involved in supporting terrorism or not?
There is a huge propaganda effort to tie Iran to everything that has happened that has produced this crisis, starting with October 7th Hamas attack. You notice even in the mainstream print media like the New York Times, they always refer to Iran-backed Houthis or Iran-backed Hezbollah, a proxy of Iran. And this is trying to create a consciousness that Iran is our major enemy in the region. And at the same time, suppressing the idea that if Iran is backing countries, what the U.S. is doing is multiple times what Iran seems to have been doing. So I think Iran has certainly sympathies with the Palestinian struggle. Those sympathies extend to its political self-interest in not being attacked, lots of problems within its own society. But it's dangerous state propaganda that is building up this notion that Iran is the real enemy standing behind this kind of anti-Israeli, quote-unquote, terrorism or criminality, as was evidenced by the October 7th attack. So I really think it's important to try to understand as accurately as possible the limited degree to which Iran is involved in the direct shaping of the conflict. Just to add a footnote, while I was special rapporteur for the UN on Israeli violations of human rights and international humanitarian law, I had the opportunity to meet and talk in detail with several of the Hamas leaders who are living either in Doha or Cairo, and also in Gaza. At that point, in the period between 2010 and 2014, Hamas was publicly and by back channels pushing for a 50-year ceasefire with Israel, conditioned on Israel carrying out the unanimous Security Council mandate of 67 that Israel withdraw to the pre-67 borders. And neither the U.S. nor Israel would respond to those diplomatic initiatives. And Hamas, Michel particularly, who was perhaps the most intellectual of the leaders, claimed that he warned Washington through reliable sources that if the ceasefire wasn't accepted or negotiated about, it would produce a period of tragic violence for both sides.
You're listening to Richard Falk on Gaza, A Case of Genocide. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Question here from Mike Hager. Where can Palestinians go as the population suffers from famine and continued bombing? And I guess the question kind of related to this, I'd add here, is to what degree do you think Israel is pursuing the so-called commitment to thinning the Gazan population and to a functional second Nakba?
I mean, this is a criminal policy. I don't know that it has to have a formal name, but this is not a policy that's designed to achieve anything but the decapitation of the Palestinian population. If that's the objective, then one has to ask whether that objective will bring any kind of long-term security to Israel, aside from what it means from a human point of view. I think the answer is negative. So I don't know what it means, the proposal that Israel made that the population simply moves south to where? The Egyptian Sinai? Well, the Egyptians have already indicated that they don't welcome this. This is not a policy. This is some kind of a threat of elimination that is to be carried out.
If I could just add that the Israeli campaign after October 7th was not directed toward Hamas's terrorism so much as it was directed toward the forced evacuation of the Palestinians from Gaza and the dispossession in the West Bank. If Israel really wanted to deal with its own security in an effective way, they're much more efficient methods that would not have exposed the entire civilian population of Gaza to this kind of massive terrorist genocidal attack. And so one has to question the motivations. At best, Israel used the October 7th attack as a pretext for a pre-existing plan to get rid of the Palestinians to the extent they could. And we should remember that before October 7th. And since the Netanyahu coalition government took power, it was known as the most extreme